Well, that wasn't right. I accidentally hit the wrong intro. That's the snippet intro for stuff that's not meant to be an episode. Here is the proper introduction for,
okay.
for the episode. Accept no substitutes. The Kato Gottfried theme here is basically sacrosanct. I think it's really a nice theme. I picked it out, and it's in the public domain. The person who did it decided to put it in the public domain. So even though the show didn't pay any money for it, I think it's an outstanding theme all the same. And I'll just say very quickly, good evening, everyone. I'm Joseph Kato. And before I say another word, you want to understand the world around you, maybe even yourself, a bit better than you do now? Are you looking for answers to some of life's greatest questions, even if they are the most difficult ones? Maybe you just want to learn something new. In any case, online great books may be just what you are looking for. You sign up for a course there by following the link below. Kato Gottfried gets $45. Learn about the past, insight on our present, and the future by learning at online great books. Knowledge is power. Joining me tonight is my esteemed co-host, the one, the only, Paul Gottfried. Paul, how's it going?
Fine. It's been very cold here lately. I don't know what it's like where you are, but it was down to 40 degrees. And I'm dressed as I was for winter, and it's probably not going to warm up for another 2-3 days here.
That's almost unbelievable because at this time of the year, it's often pretty warm where you are. So 40 degrees, that's really, doesn't do much for, I suppose, the global warming argument.
Yeah. Well, it was 94 degrees. I think it was 2 days ago. The temperature plummeted yesterday and it's become even colder today.
They had snow in Toronto.
I know. Watching.
I mean, it's, yeah, I'm sure you saw too. It's crazy. I mean, for this time of the year, I have no clue. What sort of, did you know what this?
Excuse me?
Can you hear me? I'm sorry. Did I go out?
No, I can hear you again.
Mm-hmm. Great. I know. Do you have any idea what caused this bizarre weather? Is it like an Arctic blast?
It was just some kind of cold front that came through. Other parts of the country are quite warm.
Yeah,
we have, and I'm sure down where you are, it's probably about 300 degrees by now.
It's in the low 90s.
Low 90s. Yeah, it was in low 90s here too, before this cold front came through.
It's, you know, I actually think you're lucky because I love those cold snaps. I like weather when it's in the 40s through the 60s. I even like colder weather as well, but, you know, not everybody does. So I guess
I share your passion for colder weather. I do not like hot, humid weather of the kind that you got down in Florida. I couldn't bear it. Alabama. No, you know, I have nothing against Southerners. I just don't like their heat.
Well, you know, here in the wintertime, it does get pretty cold. In some cases, it's colder than it is in London during the winter, bizarre as that might sound, because we don't get any sort of sea breeze to mitigate things, and there's really no tropical breeze here at any time in the winter months. And this isn't the tropics where I am in Florida, at least. Anyway, so we do get a change of weather, but it's really nice this late into the year to have the, or I guess it's not terribly, it's not like late in the year, but it's late in the early part of the year, at least to have the sort of cool front that you're getting.
Yeah. Well, I was in Israel about 10 years ago and, I discovered that the winter is the rainy season. Mm-hmm. You know, they pray in Hebrew for Geshem, which is rain. So the crops will come up. But that's in the winter it rains, you know, and then it gets very hot afterwards. But the temperature was fairly mild. It was, you know, probably about 40, 45 degrees. I did go swimming in the Dead Sea, dead of winter. Uh-huh. And the Dead Sea is warm, but you come out, it's, you know, it's like 40 degrees or something. Even it's supposed to be the lowest point in the world. Mm-hmm. You know, the water is warm and then you come out and it's not quite winter. It's sort of autumn weather that you encounter.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I don't know if Paul, I think you hear me now. I was going to say, it's interesting because where I am in Florida, I think it's about as far, it's about equal with Elon in Israel, just slightly south of there. And Elon, around the year, it's very warm there, as I understand it. It's very hot. That's the southernmost point in Israel. But it's interesting beach.
Yeah, I'm trying to think about this. Most of Europe, as you know, is like up in Newfoundland or something. It's much farther north than we are here. So when you take the airplane, you cross over from Newfoundland and you're right in the middle of Europe. But I'm thinking that Israel probably would be quite far south. I mean, it's certainly farther south than Europe, but I'm sort of looking at the eastern seaboard. By the time you get down to by the time you're in Florida,
it's about equal with Morocco,
right? It'd be about the same as Morocco.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and parts of Egypt, the whole thing. Of course, if you go really far south of Florida, I think you're even south. I know you're south of Morocco. There, it's interesting. It's really something else. I mean, I would like to get into it more. But there is something I have to say now. Robert Wenzel passed away earlier this week. He passed away either late Monday night or early Tuesday morning. He died in his sleep either way. And it was totally unexpected. It was a great shock and a great loss, not only to, one might say, the world of political theory. Bob was a very prominent libertarian theorist. But it also was a loss to the world of economic analysis because he was a very sharp, very popular, and very much in demand economic analyst. He had a prominent newsletter, EPJ Daily Alert, that, as I mentioned, it either made a lot of folks wealthy or it stopped a lot of folks from becoming poor. And mm-hmm. beyond that, Bob was just like a guy who was like something like a polymath, like also like a jack of all trades. He mm-hmm. had a video show. It was on online radio podcast as well. He did financial consulting. He did business things that in publishing. He ran a small publishing house. He did other stuff too, as I recall. I knew Bob for years, as did Paul, and I worked with Bob as well. He was a great, great supporter of Cato Gottfried. Without Bob, actually, Cato Gottfried, mm-hmm. the show you now see, would not exist. It just wouldn't. He was a huge behind-the-scenes supporter and consultant of the show, and so he his death is very very profoundly felt here, and it's a very sorry thing on general principle. I did interview him early last week, and it was just a few hours over 7 days, literally, before he died. And at the end of our discussion, this is what he had to say about Cato Gottfried. This has been a very great discussion, Bob. Thank you for stopping by. We wound up going over time and discussing much more than Amazon, but it was an absolutely worthwhile discussion all the same. And it should go without saying that anytime you'd like to come back on the show, let me know, because there's always something to talk about.
Okay, great. Joseph, enjoyed it. Always enjoy the show. And I always enjoy your conversations with Paul Gottfried. You guys do a great, great job. Extremely underrated show. One of the best going. I learn a lot every time.
He was a great admirer of you, Paul, intellectually. He thought you were one of the most brilliant political theorists who ever existed, which is saying something, because he was a political theorist too. And he said that he watched no political show regularly other than Cato Gottfried. He thought that this show was that good. And he and I were going to strategize to get the show a bigger audience, and we were actually going to be doing that this week, but he died too soon. But anyway, so on his last interview here, which might have been his last interview period, at the end of that interview, he was saying good things about this program. And I think that, you know, is truly a touching thing. Paul, anything to say?
Yeah, I was very, very fond of Bob. And, you know, we became good friends. I'm looking at the picture of him in this last interview, and he does look very tired, much more so than, you know, than he did during the times that we were together a year ago or 8 months ago, whenever. Nonetheless, it was a shock that he died. He wasn't that old. And I always thought of him as a very vigorous man. And he, you know, as I said, he sort of burned the candle at both ends. And you know, I suppose I'm both grieved and shocked, you know, that he died. He was much younger than me too. But looking at that picture, he does look extremely tired. You know, it might have been cumulative exhaustion that led to his heart problem.
It's really strange. It might have been a heart attack, might have been a stroke, but it's strange because Bob is someone who, as Paul and I were just discussing, had a lot of energy. On any given day, he'd be in one part of the country, and then he'd be in a different part of the country, and he's always coming and going, doing all sorts of interesting things for his business pursuits, as well as for his journalistic pursuits, because his big blog, Economic Policy Journal, got, I don't know how many million views, tens of millions of views. It was a huge blog, and he was very influential, Bob, even though he wasn't the most famous of people. He was very influential among people who are quite famous. He was sort of like a guy behind the scenes who provided ideas and analysis. And he made a big mark among people who really make a difference. So I could see why he might have died of something related to, you know, overexhaustion, because I didn't even notice it seeing that image of him there. But perhaps he had aged a bit over the last few years. And you know, given the schedule that he kept and the fact that he still found time essentially to be a playboy, he really had his hands full. So he lived more in a single lifetime than most people do. Yeah, no question about that.
Yeah, I think you're right. He sort of lived several lifetimes in one lifetime. he made full use of his time on this earth. But still, I think we're grieved that he died, and we've lost a good friend.
Without doubt, and the show has lost a good friend too. It's really just a terrible situation. You know, Bob, toward the end, he told me that doing something like EPJ and his other blog, which also got tens of millions of views, but much less, Target Liberty, he mentioned that these publications, he could not start them today from scratch as he did them because of tech censorship. He would be shadow banned. There would be, you know, Google ads delisting him. So he was very glad to have started these blogs when he did, and to have attained the sort of influence that he attained when he did. But he was extremely concerned, and we discussed this very often. He was extremely concerned about the future of a discourse, that people would be deplatformed, that they would be essentially unpersoned, and that people would not be able to speak freely in the realm of today's censorship craze. And he was, even though he was a devout Orthodox libertarian, that was basically his religion. But he was very skeptical, extremely skeptical of big tech all the same. And he was actually deplatformed by Amazon about a week and a half, I think, before he died. And he just got his book back on right before I did that interview with him. So he was very nervous about what's going on now. And I think the fight against big tech censorship very much is continuing on in the name of Bob Wenzel. It's interesting because a lot of libertarians are not anti big tech at all. They're rather slavishly devoted to big tech. But not Bob. You know, he understood what was going on there, and he was trying to find ways around it. But it's just, you know, it's terrible. So, yeah, he lived a full life. We were very glad to have known him. The show would not be here without him, no exaggeration. So to Bob Wenzel, I don't raise my glass, I raise my bottle. He was a great guy, and he will be missed. And there will also be a tribute episode to him here where people who knew him come on to chat next week. So that should be something else. Paul, I mean, if you'd like to join in for that, you can. I don't know what your schedule is, but
okay, no, it's quite possible. I mean, depending on the time, you know, that this is scheduled.
I think it's going to be on Thursday at 8 o'clock Eastern.
In the evening?
Yep.
Yeah, okay. I can make that.
Great. Good. I think it'll be a very good, enlightening discussion. Anyway, now I will say that if you have a reasonable, responsible question or comment for Paul or myself, please do leave it via Streamlabs and we'll get to it. I almost said a reasonable, responsible question for Bob or myself, because that's what I was saying last week. But no, from Paul or myself, please do leave it and we will get to it. But please leave it as soon as you can. Thank you very much in advance. So, you know, Paul, I think that looking at where things are going now in America, it's rather interesting. It seems like there's less and less search for common ground, let alone common ground. And the way I see the left and the right nowadays, they really do seem to be diverging. They're on different paths. And there's not really an interest in having any sort of moderate politics as we would see during times gone by. Anything to say about that, Bob?
Yeah, I think...
But Bob, Paul, holy Moses. Paul, anything to say?
Yes, I knew you meant... I think the problem is that the left has moved so far to the left on some issues, not so much in economics, but on cultural, social issues and trying to impose LGBT and Black Lives Matter and so forth on society, that much of the right has just given up, you know, any thought of compromise. And I think for a very long time, what there is of an American right is to the right of the Republican Party, and to the right of the conservative establishment. The Democratic Party and the left and so forth are exactly with the people who support them. But according to an observation that Sam Francis made years ago, which I think is accurate, the right in the United States is to the right of the Republican Party, which perhaps may be closer to the Democratic Party than to the real right, which is a populist right, which is made up very often of gun owners, people living in peripheral areas or outside of large urban areas and so forth. And they're very, very pissed off with the way things are going in this country. Most of them think the election was stolen, you know, and there's a good reason to believe that it was. You know, the attempt to brand them as right-wing extremists and to use the FBI and Secret Service to go after them and then to cancel them from electronic media and so forth, I think just adds to their rage. I'm not sure there is much common ground left in the United States. It's just that it's inconceivable that these areas are just going to, the right is somehow going to break off and leave. I just don't see this happening. What, as I said, is more likely is that, you know, it will try by stages to gain independence from the central government. And the central government, you know, is not going to take away the guns because they're afraid of violence. And there could be a lot of violence. They're probably going to back off, even if they have this... this fellow, I can't remember his name, the one who was being interviewed, a Chipman or someone like that, that is not going to work. You know, I mean, it's too obvious that he wants to confiscate people's guns. I think the Second Amendment issues, I think, may be the most the most delicate or the tinderbox that can sort of cause everything to go off. And I think they're going to back off. I think the central government may start backing off with critical race theory too, because it's starting to offend too many people. What I do find remarkable is that despite, you know, the screw ups under Biden, despite his obvious dementia, 55% of the American people, according to Rasmussen, and the number is going up, think he's a great president. They love him. They do not in any way blame him for the problems that are besetting this country. I find that extraordinary. By the way, I do believe Rasmussen. I don't think that this is like Fox News polls or CBS polls or Quinnipiac. I think this is a reliable. They've proven to be reliable. I'm not quite sure how Biden has achieved this. Even though the media do everything to cover up for him, to, you know, every time he says something that's utterly moronic and incoherent, they reinterpreted and declared to be a gem of wisdom and so forth. But I'm still unsure of how they're bringing this off. And, you know, sort of looking and listening to Biden, I have absolutely no idea why he enjoys 55% approval. And it used to be 51, 50, it's up to 55%. The more he screws up, the higher his approval rating goes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. I think what we're seeing here is a phenomenon that I've identified as the cultural democratic voter. It is a voter who cares first and foremost about loathing the GOP and opposing the GOP, because this cultural democratic voter sees the Republican Party as an existential threat to this, you know, voter's personal as well as collective identity. So in return, this cultural democratic voter has a group-based loathing of Republicans. So the Democrat will be supported no matter what. Even I believe in New York Magazine, there was an article about the fact that approval ratings now have less to do with job performance and more to do with just partisan solidarity. So I think that's exactly what we're seeing with Biden.
Yeah, but the 55% suggests to me that he's picking up independent voters as well as hardcore Democrats, right? I mean, the hardcore Democrats would not give him 55% approval. Right. There are not that many of them, you know, I mean, even if we assume they're 48-49%, they're not going to be 55%. So he's picking up that additional support from somewhere else.
Yeah, probably left leaning independents who are not registered Democrats, mm-hmm. that might have been a bit soft on him before. But for whatever reason now, maybe because of this January 6th commission, or, you know, the nonsense in New York with the Attorney General and Donald Trump, they're becoming more galvanized in Biden's corner. I think it has to do with some, like, sort of group or personality-based politics that boils down to resentment.
Yeah, it's also, I think, the fact that he's not Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. He's the anti-Trump president. Yeah. And the media and academy invested tremendous energy for 4 years bringing down Trump. I think Trump sort of played into their hands by some of his incoherent rage, you know, rants and so forth. But I think that any Republican who stood in their way would have received more or less the same treatment. Mm-hmm. I mean, it could have been Mitt Romney. They would have destroyed him. You know,
go ahead. Sorry.
No, I don't think this. This denigration of a Republican president is something that was visited exclusively on Donald Trump. I think it could have happened to some, but then Trump's personality sort of lent itself to this denigration, because, you know, he fought back, and sometimes he just went after his targets randomly. You know, they could be rock stars or sports figures or something like that. I mean, he should have simply stayed out of those arguments. But I don't think his fate was simply the result of his personality. I think it was the fact that he could be identified with the right and the Republican Party, and even be depicted as some kind of Nazi. By the way, it was a piece by David Harsanyi, who is who's a columnist. I think he works with the Federalist, in which he pointed out that, you know, now the Democrats are going after this Marjorie Greene, who made some statement, you know, comparing the mask to stars, gold stars that Jews were required to wear in Nazi Germany, and they're just beating up on her. And Harsanyi is Jewish, but he points out that for 4 years, the Democrats said Donald Trump was Hitler, right? Mm-hmm. And nobody cared. The Anti-Defamation League didn't complain. Jewish organizations were quite happy with that. This lady is a conservative Republican. That's why they're going after her for saying much, much less, you know. And she's also been stripped, I think, of her congressional assignments or something like that.
Yep. Yeah. So there are apparently some Republicans who are going to try to challenge her in her district, which will be redrawn, but it'll still, I think, unless they gerrymander her out, which is always possible, I think that it'll be still a very conservative district, so she should win re-election. I think she'll be around on Capitol Hill for some time to come. Mm-hmm. I think she's something like a reality TV politician in the same vein as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I think all these people are sort of cut from the same cloth, essentially a lot of attention-seeking women, and also people like Adam Kinzinger, who are attention-seeking men that act like 16-year-old girls. So I think they all sort of blend together.
But look at the difference in the way she's treated.
Absolutely.
Marjorie's treated from the way that the squad is treated.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the squad is venerated, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They're treated as, you know, respectable political consultants, analysts, who are speaking to power. And, of course, they do have power. Whereas Marjorie is considered some kind of dangerous neo-Nazi, you know, you have to put in her place and so forth. She was stripped of her committee assignments, but nobody stripped Maxine Waters of her committee assignment, right?
Mm-hmm.
After she tried to incite riots in Minneapolis.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing happened to her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not surprising. I think the Democrats have no interest in any sort of like compromise or whatnot, because they know they're going to lose the House next year. So their goal is to get through everything they can now. And that includes also, you know, a likelihood of losing the U.S. It's not as likely as the U.S. House, but they could lose the U.S. Senate. So they realize that they're in hot water next year. So they're trying to get through as much as they can. So why waste time, you know, chastising Maxine Waters when her delisting from a committee really wouldn't make much difference one way or the other, except to aggravate her base.
Yeah, you know, it's dawned on me with Biden that he may be around for a long time, even though he is senile, lies, you know, is incoherent, because he is so popular, whereas Kamala Harris is not. You know, somebody pointed out that she was not a 2020 presidential candidate. She fell out in 2019 before the voting began. You know, she's hated. Nobody likes her. So whereas the media have been able to turn Biden into this wise grandfatherly figure, right? So, you know, why get rid? It's quite possible that he may be another Obama or even Eisenhower, who, even as his party loses Congress, you know, retains the support of the majority of Americans, many of whom look up to him. I mean, I am a great admirer of Eisenhower. So, you know, it hurts me to make this comparison. And even Obama, you know, sounds like Socrates next to this guy. And nothing seems to hurt Biden. Like, of course, nobody's ever heard about Hunter Biden because it's the electronic media, you know, cancel you if you bring this up. And, you know, the New York Post and Miranda Devine may go after Hunter, but most people don't know and don't care. Right. So this is not hurt Biden at all.
But it's worth noting because Chronicles, which you are the chief editor of, actually was canceled for running something about Hunter Biden, as I recall, right?
Right. Well, that was actually Intellectual Takeout, which Annie Holmquist is in charge of. I suppose I have some, you know, oversight of that, but she's the one actually running it. And she authorized some article that criticized Hunter Biden. And she was immediately, you know, removed from Facebook, and only now they sort of get back on. It's sort of intermittent. They're afraid to say anything. And, you know, they were getting a lot of their hits because of Facebook. But, you know, and this was done, by the way, before the election, but they were never really restored. I mean, they were sort of given a kind of provisional status of being allowed to use Facebook, you know, for a while. Then they can never be sure. Her assistant keeps telling me that, you know, they go on, they pull them off or something like that. But the offense was bringing up the Hunter Biden connection to Ukraine and China and so forth just before the election.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting because the Hunter Biden thing, really, the media went out of its way to destroy that. I don't just mean the establishment media, I mean social media too. It got to be so you couldn't even share the link to the New York Post article talking about the Biden scandal, so that they would go after the Charlemagne Institute for, you know, posting whatever intellectual takeout posted. It's not surprising. And these people all do work hand in hand. That's the problem. And that's what Bob Wenzel noticed. And it's why he was so nervous about what's going on now. Because
some people say, you know, the Biden or these people are Marxist. Well, my problem with that is corporate capitalism is running this. I mean, how Marxist can they be? You know, I mean, obviously they're going to tax other people. It's going to be poor working class people who lose their shirts. Mm-hmm. But the corporate capitalists are going to come out very well, and nothing's going to happen to them because this administration owes its position or its victory to corporate capitalists, right? To the electronic media, to others who gave it money, who stand by it, and so forth. They're not going to turn on their patrons.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that what's going on now is a form of cultural Marxism, but it's not even like an orthodox Marxism. It's something turned on its head into intersectionality, social mm-hmm. justice, various things. And there is, among many, most elements of the left, a sort of Marxian economic undercurrent, but the leadership of the left doesn't take that very seriously. But many of the peons on the left do. It's an interesting dichotomy.
No, I think you're right. The people mm-hmm. below are just stupid and used or just intellectually arrogant idiots, cretins, mm-hmm. you know, and they allow themselves to be used. The people on top are not Marxist. I think serious Marxists would have to understand that this is all fake, you know, and it's being done probably. I think Pedro Gonzalez had a very good, he spoke about the ruling class strikes back. And that's my view of it. This is the ruling class that's striking back. And this is also the tie-in with fascism. The real tie-in, not the junk you read in Jonah Goldberg. The real tie-in with fascism is the fascists were the bourgeoisie who were afraid of losing their power. They make an alliance with political fascists to protect them. And they claim they're carrying out a national revolution. But at the same time, they're always pretending that we're out of power. We have to arrive at power, even when they're running everything. This is what the left does in the United States, what I call the counter-revolutionary left, you know, the intersectional left. We're out of power because there's one person in Duluth, Minnesota, who used the word Negro rather than the word black, or didn't say Ms., but said Mrs., or whatever nonsense they bring up. But they're always out of power. Or there's Washington Lee has not been renamed, Sharpton and Maxine Waters universities. So we really haven't arrived at full power yet. And this is exactly the nonsense you get from the ruling class. But I don't think their fortunes are going to be hurt at all. I think they're going, you know, Bezos is going to have like, you know, $100 billion more dollars. He's not going to be hurt. It's the poor jerk who drives the, well, if you drive, you're a truck driver, you're okay now. Because the shortage of everything, even though Biden is so enormously popular. But, you know, there are working stiffs out there who are going to get hit with these taxes. And small businesses will get hit, and the small capitalists are going to get hit. But the administration doesn't care because these people aren't on their side anyhow. The ones who are going to get hit are people who voted against the government. They're going to pay the taxes, just as they're going to be investigated by the FBI.
Mm-hmm. And I will say, if you have a reasonable, responsible question or comment for Paul or myself, please do leave it via Streamlabs, and we'll get to it. Thank you very much in advance. Now, I will look at Streamlabs. There is something here from David B., and I think what he meant to say is Gottfried is a national treasure. Very kind words for Paul. it's interesting because people, when it comes to Paul, have very polarized opinions. Either they think very highly of him or they don't. And it's good to see that he has so many admirers, because over the years, you've attracted no shortage of blood enemies.
That's correct. And unfortunately, my enemies are much more powerful than my friends. I wish we were the other way around.
Well, at least you're still here. That means a lot. Mm-hmm. From David B., he says, "You're probably right, but this is depressing." Not sure what that's in reference to, but a lot of things nowadays are depressing. So I think it could apply to a great many things. Paul, anything to say about what David brought up?
I'm not quite sure. What is the question?
He said, "You're probably right, but this is depressing." I'm not sure what that was in reference to, but so many things are depressing nowadays that I think it could apply to a great deal of stuff going on.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, the world has always been depressing. People are depressing. I still try to call the shots I see them. And one of the things that strike me about the present political and cultural situation is that what's going on is so obvious. And yet, you know, people in power and others just try to deny it. You know, there isn't an attempt to take over culture, politics, everything by this intersectional left with their corporate capitalist allies, their allies in the deep state. And now they have, you know, military brass behind them and surveillance operations and so forth. And they always move in the same direction. I mean, it's obvious where they're going. And then you have these so-called moderates who pretend that, you know, this is not what's really happening and we have to just compromise or something like that. or we have to go back to the way things were 10 years ago, as if that's going to make you may be able to buy 10 minutes of time or something, but everything is going to go in the same direction, you know, unless it meets a counterforce.
From Douglas Edward, 84. If that was Robert Wenzel's final interview, I think it was a great one to finish on. Excellent discussion with him, Joseph, and I share Bob's sentiments on Cato Gottfried entirely. His voice was needed to confront madness like modern monetary theory. Very, very kind remarks, Douglas Edward. It was a great chat with Bob. It was certainly one of the last interviews he did, might have been the last one, like I said. But he really had a great opinion of the show, as you mentioned, and his voice was needed to confront all sorts of craziness. Paul, anything to say about what Douglas?
No, I absolutely agree with him. On economic issues, he was extremely sound. Mm-hmm. And he was also, I think, a cultural conservative at the end of the day, culture as well as a political conservative. So his voice will be missed. And I think he was a powerful influence for the good.
Mm-hmm. Most certainly. You know, Bob often defined being libertarian as not necessarily being on the right. But at the end of the day, he did have very much culturally conservative instincts, mm-hmm. and certainly economically conservative views, as many libertarians do of the old school. He was not a fan of the left libertarians, even though he didn't call himself a member of the right. But at the end of the day, he despised the social justice warriors and the woke folks, and he wrote about them to no end. And he actually did some of the most brilliant coverage of these people that could be found, I think, almost anywhere. And very reliable coverage, too. He was on their case like gangbusters. And that was something else. So his interests obviously went far beyond economics. He was, like I said, a political theorist as well, along with many other things.
Yeah, the I find that paleo-libertarians, who are generally libertarians of the right, do not really define themselves as conservatives or the right or something like that. And they do very often they focus on economic issues, but their positions do have conservative implications. And, you know, if you probe beneath the surface, you find that they agree with you on most of these cultural social issues.
You know, one interesting thing that Bob and I discussed in that last interview toward the end of it was that the right doesn't understand the left, in that the left desires power above all else, and it has really no principles or standards or whatever. And Bob actually took out an ice pick that he had, which is a replica of the one that was used to kill Trotsky. And he explained to people that he keeps this around to remind him of the fact that the left is not like him, a libertarian, or like people on the right who have scruples about stuff because of their belief in individual rights and liberties. His point to people is that the left does crazy stuff all the time without any regard for, you know, what you call common decency, because it wants power and power for its own sake. So it will contradict itself. It will take a position that it lambasted 2 days ago. It will do all this stuff simply because it desires power above all else. And that, in his view, and it's a view that I agree with, and I know you agree with, makes the left very dangerous.
You know, he's absolutely correct. I mean, you cannot compromise with them because they know where they're going. They're totalitarians. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, they want to strip other people of power, the right to express dissenting views, and so. And they just move inexorably relentlessly in this direction every second. They know where they're going. I think the real right knows where they're going as well, but the real right does not have power for the most part. You know, the I do not consider, you know, Sean Hannity, Mark Levin, Jonah Goldberg representing the real right. They occasionally, I mean, they're Republicans, they're neoconservatives, whatever they are. But I speak to deplorables. I live among them and they know exactly what's happening. You know, they might use salty language in this, but, you know, and they're not always grammatical, but they know exactly what the left is doing. They want total power. They're not interested in democracy or sharing power. By the way, the reference to the pick, the ice pick with which Trotsky was killed by an agent of Stalin in Mexico, you know, brings with it an interesting story. Murray Rothbard, who was Wenzel's hero, was always bringing up that story. However, he interpreted it in a very different way. Murray was convinced that Trotsky was much more dangerous than Stalin because he believed in international revolution. And Stalin, you know, as brutal as he was, at least for a long time, wanted socialism in one country. Of course, when he got a chance after the Second World War, he branched out and, you know, engaged in mass murder in Eastern Europe and other places. But for Murray, Trotsky was more dangerous than Stalin. And that was generally my view, that, you know, as bad as Stalin is, he was not going to, unless you really gave him the opportunity, he was not going to work day and night to destabilize other societies. Yeah. whereas Trotsky and the Comintern wanted to do that. So I went, every time Murray mentioned that pick, he said that, you know, Stalin was right, that Trotsky was a dangerous person. It was exactly, you know, exactly the opposite view he would take from the one I think that Bob Wenzel may have been expressing when he showed you when he referred to the pick, the ice pick with which Trotsky was killed.
He was no fan of Trotsky. Bob, like you and like me, despised neoconservatism, and he did trace it back to Trotsky. And he didn't like Trotsky, but he thought that it was interesting that the left would turn on itself so viciously over something that, you know, seemingly petty. I mean, it was an issue with Stalin having Trotsky, but it wasn't like an end of the world tier thing. But that was Bob's point there. And also, yeah,
I used to joke, and I remember Murray joking that we both said we were Stalinist. Because they consider Trotsky more dangerous.
But Murray Rothbard was another one who died too soon. I think he was only in his mid or late 60s, right?
Mid-60s, but then Murray was in dreadful physical condition. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, he did not watch what he ate. They told him, don't eat, all this fatty food. He would just go ahead and eat it. Mm-hmm. He never really looked after his health. And the last time I saw him, you know, before he died, he really did look like he was ailing. And if, you know, if Murray had looked after himself a bit better, I think he would have lived a lot longer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, some people tried to get him to convert, I think, to Roman Catholicism right before he died, but he always rebuffed their desires.
but he did lean toward the Roman Catholic position. Like, he went out of his way to try to credit Roman Catholics with capitalism. You know, looking at, well, there were Jesuits who actually did, you know, did like what's his name? The I'm trying to think of the, was it Juan Marino in the 16th century or 17th century who did defend capitalism and something that looked like Locke's social contract. But that was sort of unusual, that the more traditional way of looking at capitalism developing, among Calvinists and Protestants and during the Industrial Revolution in England, theories are developed defending capitalist activity. Those are the more common. Of course, Calvinists were the first to allow commercial loans and say that they're argue they're totally different from loaning people things for, you know, physical needs, And of course, we know in Deuteronomy, it's forbidden to loan your kinsman or your friend or something, anything from which you're going to profit if you're giving it to him for some need, you know, for some immediate need. And Calvin was the first within the Judeo-Christian tradition to go outside of that argument and say that, you know, the commercial loans are fine. Go ahead and make them, you know, and he urged ministers to do this. So in terms of the development of capitalism, I think certainly the Protestants, the Calvinists, not so much Lutherans, were clearly forerunners, theoretical forerunners. But Murray denied this, you know, and he tried to always give Catholics the credit. He also insisted that, you know, his Lockeanism has to be understood through Thomas Aquinas. So, I mean, there really was, his wife was a Presbyterian, by the way, but there was this, you know, the strong attachment to the Catholic Church, which, you know, you found in Murray Rothbard.
Very, very strange.
It is. I agree.
All right, then. To each his own. From Event Horizon, how bad do you think inflation is going to get? I bought a home in lieu of renting as a hedge, which seems smart due to the price of lumber and other building supplies. Also, how much credibility has the medical establishment lost due to COVID response? I think inflation could get very bad. I think Bob Wenzel was covering this in the run-up to his death. The Biden administration seems to be just fine with rampant inflation for the time being. And they seem to, the Biden administration seems to think that this is going to be good in some way, shape, or form for its overall economic policy. Rather bizarre from my standard, but I think inflation is going to go on for a while. And obviously, the people at the bottom, or not even people at the bottom, just people who are, you know, vastly wealthy, are going to be very hard hit by this. It's certainly something that I'm not looking forward to. I'm already very leery of it and concerned by it. So that's my opinion about inflation. I don't know if there's like a specific, you know, dollar amount that it would go to that would be, you know, considered worst it could possibly get. But I think it's just going to get worse because the Biden administration doesn't seem to mind printing a bunch of dollars to redistribute, even though, of course, that reduces the power of the dollar and hurts people's purchasing power. As for credibility to the medical establishment due to COVID response, I think that's lost a lot, certainly on the right, on the left. I think that there is a sort of slavish devotion to it for political purposes, but the right, which is sort of skeptical of it already, I think has become much more skeptical. But I don't think you can say exactly, it can't exactly be quantified. But I think that it has certainly become fashionable across the board on the right to now look at the medical establishment with deep suspicion, whereas before it was only certain sort of libertarian-leaning or outright, you know, kook elements of the right which had this perspective. But certainly that's no longer the case. Paul, anything to say about what Event Horizon brought up?
Yeah, I think we're going to get a lot of inflation. We might get stagflation as we had under Carter, where the economy becomes stagnant and at the same time inflation goes up. I don't think they care. I think Biden is probably looking at his popularity ratings right now and saying that, you know, he's absolutely invulnerable, and he may be. I mean, you know, this can just go on. I mean, conditions are getting worse and worse in the country and his popularity is soaring. So why should he care? He might lose control of the House of Representatives, but hold on to the Senate or this. But pursuing these irresponsible policies, which are advocated by the squad or the extreme left of the Democratic Party, has not hurt him at all, personally. It has not done anything to affect his presidency. If his poll numbers start tanking, you know, if one day he sees that he's down to 35%, approval ratings, I think this will stop. But so far, this has not been the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know how much worse it will get, but I think it could get one hell of a lot worse. I see something here from David B., but it's just a very generous transfer to the show. But at the same time, there's no comment associated with it. David, if you meant to leave a comment and didn't go through for whatever reason, just throw it in the regular live chat and I will get to it. And then there's also something here from Jonathan to Paul. What intellectual thinkers do you miss most?
Do you mean intellectual figures who have
It says, to Paul, what intellectual thinkers do you miss most?
Do I miss most? Now, I think he's referring to people who are deceased.
I believe so as well, yep.
Well, I mean, if you read my book, Encounters, just about everybody there is deceased by now, and I miss them all. As I point out again and again, if you look at the American conservative movement now and look what it was, let's say around 1960, you're really struck by the decline in intellectuality and the unbelievable decline in the quality of thinking. aside from the fact that it's moved, you know, well to the left of where it was before, but I mean, National Review was once a serious publication. You have a few serious people still writing for it, like McCarthy on legal questions and so forth. Most of the stuff is silly. The editor is silly. Buckley may have given in to the neoconservatives, but, you know, before that, he was an absolutely brilliant polemicist. James Burnham, Nisbet, most of these people whom I write about were serious thinkers. So there are a lot of people that I miss. I miss Ray Rothbard, who, you know, I didn't always agree with, but I thought was a brilliant economic thinker with a scintillating personality. And although I've written a great deal, I envy the facility with which he wrote. I people say I'm a writing machine. I could never equal his efficiency and even eloquence as a writer. there's lots of great thinkers I knew who are Eugene Genovese, who, you know, most of his life was theoretically a Marxist, but was an absolutely brilliant historian. You know, the greatest American social historian, certainly of my lifetime. The people I worked with at Telos, like Paul Piccone, who's now been gone for years, we were close friends. I thought he was a very stimulating, it's sort of a kind of almost agent provocateur. I mean, he would just, you know, provoke you into discussions where you didn't want to go. He would never be allowed into the conservative movement because he was so entirely non-prescribed. I miss him as well. And in my age, you know, I miss the entire generation of thinkers who preceded me who are now gone.
And from David B., I think he remembered, how would you compare McCarthyism to cancel culture? That's interesting. I think this is my impression is that this is really for Paul, but I'll just say briefly, I think that both are based on an idea that people have ideas that are too dangerous to be disseminated. So for the sake of moral betterment, if you will, they must be shut down, and people in the radical lengths must be gone to shut down these people because they are too socially destabilizing to have a platform. I would say that's really the similarity between McCarthyism and cancel culture. There are differences. Obviously, McCarthyism was used by the right. Cancel culture is generally used by the left. And cancel culture has a sort of cultural Marxist milieu, while McCarthyism was about preserving a sort of Norman Rockwellian American identity that was very prominent during the post-war American society. Paul, anything to say about what David B. brought up?
Yeah, I think that one cannot compare them at all. I think it's ridiculous to compare them. McCarthy was reacting to a real communist threat. He may have been sloppy in his methods. He may have made some questionable accusations. But the United States was engaged in a global conflict with the Soviet Union, and there were spies in our government. And there were spies who got in there during the Roosevelt administration, particularly. McCarthy was going after people who he thought were communist agents or people who were in security positions who could not be trusted. And some of his accusations were correct. I would not go as far as M. Stanton Evans, who wrote a book on McCarthy, a 500-page well-researched book showing that most of McCarthy's accusations were quite accurate. I think there were some people who were harmed by them who probably, you know, were unfairly accused. I do not like McCarthy's methods at all. But, you know, as I tell people, compared to the, to those who are now sitting in the United States Congress, he was a fine English gentleman. you know, I mean, he, and there was a real problem he was addressing. Now, the cancel culture today is addressing only one problem, which is the fact that there is a delay in the Democrats creating a one-party dictatorship in the United States. You know, their people get in the way or say the wrong things. Therefore, we have to take special actions like canceling them, packing the Supreme Court, having the federal government take over elections and allow fraudulent practices like people who pretend to be some people they're not, vote harvesting and the rest, making Washington, D.C., which is a, you know, really a drag on the rest of the country, and they're just making them into a state and making Puerto Rico and some other place. This is all part of an attempt to grab power for one party. This is why the electronic media that, that are part of this attempted coup d'etat are canceling anyone who objects to their positions on the electronic media. This has nothing to do with the other thing I point out is that universities under McCarthy remained in the hands of what was then the left. Right. Yale, most of the faculty at Yale were leftist by the standards of the time. Of course, by our standards, they'd probably be fascist or something by now. By the standards of the time, they were liberal Democrats. And, you know, many of them were, in fact, sympathetic to the communists, because I certainly remember that when I was in graduate school at Yale in the mid-1960s. So but they were not they were not touched. Most of the left was hardly touched in the United States. They remained in power, and they use this as a kind of grievance, or if you will, a cudgel to go after the other side afterwards and start kicking people out. Wilmore Kendall, who was a great political theorist, was basically pushed out of Yale in the 1950s, at least partly because he defended McCarthy. And the political science department was made up of leftist anti-McCarthyites who survived the McCarthy period without any problem. So, in terms of the significance of these things, I think the comparisons are ridiculous. And you know, I listened to the Con Inc, the conservative vulgarians on you know, Fox News. Oh, this is like McCarthy. There's nothing like McCarthyism. I mean, it's like the lady with the, you know, the mask is like the yellow star of the Nazis. It's a ridiculous comparison. McCarthyism was nothing compared to what we're living through right now. There was no McCarthyite dictatorship. People voted for Democrats, and the Congress went after McCarthy, and they got rid of him. Right? I mean, you know, the left, and the left remained in power. So in terms of the deep state, so I don't see anything. The universities, they remained in power. So McCarthyism was at best a failed, insignificant. I mean, other it were not for the propaganda that it creates, it would be an insignificant attempt, you know, by some people on the right to rein in the. And by the way, there were people on the right who were anti-McCarthyite. T.S. Eliot was strongly against McCarthy. James Burnham raised all kinds of questions about McCarthy, and he was on the far right in terms of anti-communism. So it wasn't that everybody on the right was supporting McCarthy. There were critics, and Eisenhower, who was a conservative Republican president, went after McCarthy. Mm-hmm. So you see nothing like this now, right? I mean, the left stands united in its efforts to cancel the opposition. So this is not at all like the McCarthy era.
And also from David B, do you think violence is inevitable? I would say no. Nowadays, people on the left and the right are more and more thinking that, talking about the purported inevitability of violence. It seems like a lot of people on both sides of the spectrum do want, they have some sort of bloodlust, unfortunate as that is. But I don't think that's inevitable at all. I think that there are solutions that people can use to live together peaceably, in which case they do not infringe upon each other. It requires a decentralized, devolved government. in which case the central power, the federal government, does not wield as much authority as it does now, which allows people within its jurisdiction to have enhanced representation at the state level or perhaps even the local level. And in that case, they live how they want to live. So what that means is you could have, say, in California, a situation where a child can sue his parents because his parents don't want him to become transgender. But meanwhile, in Alabama, you'd have a situation where it's illegal to perform a transgender operation on a kid. So you'd have these laws simultaneously with no means of forcing, you know, California or Alabama to do what people in the state generally find distasteful or even disdainful. So I think that peace can easily be had through separation. You see that even now where you have different groups of people that generally huddle among like minds or people who are similar to them on the basis of other characteristics. And that creates a peaceful society. So you know, I think that you know the idea that violence is inevitable is very, very much incorrect. But I think that to have true peace, you have to have a situation where people can congregate with those who are similar to them. And that's always going to offend, you know, people who think differently. If people who think differently, some of them will say, you know, this shouldn't be, everybody should think like us. That's where the problem really comes in. But if you don't have the central government that forces a certain view on people, then you can have everybody coexisting in a very peaceable fashion. And I think that's exactly what should be the case. Paul, anything to say about what David B. brought up?
Yeah, I mean, what should be the case isn't necessarily going to be the case, you know, and at some point you may have, you know, the Supreme Court made up of 13 members or 16 members, whatever number the Democrats put there, deciding to impose on the state of Alabama a requirement that they allow, young boys to be chemically castrated so they can change their gender or something. I think all of this goes back to a very dangerous precedent, although one that, you know, people at the time thought was fine. And this really goes back to the civil rights movement. And he said, you know, it's really great that we force Alabama to integrate or bus people or whatever they required. But this was going to be done through the Supreme Court. And we're going to change people's behavioral patterns. And we're going to use the federal government to do this too. Well, you see, you know, this is sort of a slam dunk case, and you know, we don't like segregation or this. But the thing is, once you empower certain federal agencies to reconstruct states and reconstruct society and so forth, this is just going to go on. And that's what we see. And then the question is, you know, what point are you going to break it off, where people are going to complain? As far as I know, there was no states that allowed transgender transformations or this a few years ago. There was no, I'm almost 80. I remember there was the idea of gay marriage would have got you in a lunatic asylum when I was growing, you know, even when I was in my 40s. Okay. So now it's being imposed on everybody. In our neighbor Canada, you know, if a minister gets up and reads from the Bible, the Old or New Testament, something against homosexuality, they may land up in jail. And this kind of thing can happen here as well. So the point is that the federal government can go too far. It can presume, it can try to impose, you know, Kamala Harris's social agenda on people. It can override states, and the Democrats that get a majority will likely do this. And this could have very dangerous, violent consequences. I don't think the right is, even though Fox News will tell them this is okay, this is the government, they should have, I'm not sure that this is going to fly very well in many of the rural areas of this country. People don't like what's going on, and even if they only make up 35 or 40% of the population, that's a lot of people who are unhappy with the direction in which the country is going. So I could imagine some kind of violence, although I would hope this would not be the way that I know I sound like Leslie Howard in Gone with the Wind, or do you remember Ashley Wilk? was saying, you know, I hope they allow our state of Georgia to leave peacefully, but if not, I'll stand with my state. Or I think that's a great line. You know, I deeply admire these Confederates, you know, going with the wind. They seem to be like real aristocratic, you know, warriors and so forth. you know, these I hope there will not be violence. I will go with my state. I don't, you can't even go with your state anymore, because Georgia is like California, right? Politically, I'd rather go with the federal government, the state of Georgia at this point. But, you know, I could envisage things becoming very nasty if the Democratic Party tries to push too hard, if it acquires the power that it seeks. You know, and then tries to force its insane agenda down the throats of all these normal Americans.
From K. Max McDonald, are you guys often amazed how other groups network together? I have seen Indians use each other to get an internet tech job, then buy a house using an Indian real estate agent, mm-hmm. and finally paying for his landscaping from an Indian. Do we need more of this? Yes, we do. Absolutely, we do. We live in the age when there is obviously a gross domestic marketplace, but at the same time, the American economy is more and more breaking down along affinity group lines. So people who have certain political beliefs or lifestyle choices patronize certain companies, while those who have divergent beliefs or lifestyle choices patronize other companies. And that, you know, creates a very fractured economy, even though it all functions within the same GDP. So I think that this is a good move, what you describe here, K-Max. I think it's a very important move for the future, so people are not reliant upon those who despise them politically or on the basis of worldview or lifestyle choice. And that problem is obviously what people who are not on the left are running into now, big tech. Paul, anything to say about what K-Max brought up?
Yeah, I would say it's not desirable. It's inevitable. Mm-hmm. You know, people are going to hang out with their own group. Mm-hmm. And they've always done this in the United States. I mean, I grew up in an ethnic neighborhood in Bridgeport, Connecticut. Italians mm-hmm. hung with Italians, Irish hung with Irish. You had Central European Jews living on the east side, on the west side. Then you had Eastern European Jews living on the east side of town, you know, and they all hung with their own group. It's good, it's bad. This is the way people have tended to live, you know, throughout history. So, you know, I think any attempt to alter these patterns would be a problem. And you say, you know, is this okay? Well, I mean, this is just the way people live and have always lived in the past. There's one problem I have with this, and this is that the farther you move away from white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, the more leftist people become politically, mm-hmm. and that's a problem to me. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't care if they hang out with their own group, that's great, or speak their language or this, you know, you look at people from India, I mean, they're very nice people, I know some, but they line up with the left. They're right wing in their own group, but they line up with the left. I always tell the story. I've been telling the story for years of a colleague of mine at Rockford College who came from India. He was a Hindu. His wife and daughters walked behind him, and I asked him, "Are you going to vote for Reagan?" Because I was so concerned. No, because Reagan opposed the Equal Rights Amendment. I'm not going to vote for him. I could understand his argument. You know, my own group, this is like a medieval feudal society. And, you know, I'm the head of the family and I have to answer to somebody else in this feudal hierarchy and so forth. But when it comes to the Gentiles out there, you know, I want them to be leftist. I want them to be open. I do not want them to have a closed society of the kind in which I am living. I want them to have exactly the opposite. So I think that this is the way ethnic minorities think. And I think it's a problem. It's a problem when they throw their weight behind the intersectional left. It becomes a problem. I don't care if they want to deal with other merchants or physicians who belong to their own ethnic group.
From K-Max as well, is the white cultural suicide unprecedented in suicide? Other groups maybe disappeared, but never voluntarily. The unique set of circumstances that led to this can be reversed, but the unique set of circumstances that led to this can be reversed before it is too late. That's a question. Can a fight be put up, in your opinion? Obviously, he's talking about a nonviolent fight. Just nowadays, you have to be specific. But I think that the cultural suicide among whites that we see now in the West, unless you're talking about, say, Eastern Europe, is very much unprecedented. The closest thing that comes to it is perhaps the internal destruction of the Roman Empire. But I would say that it is unprecedented, at least insofar as I can tell. And I think that I don't think the situation can really be reversed. I think that what it is there is going to be small groups of Western folk who are self-preservation minded, and they survive in communities of their own design. So the struggle would be then to preserve these communities over time. Paul, anything to say about what K-Max brought up?
Yeah, although I've published entire books on the subject, I remain puzzled by the extent to which Western white Christians seem to be wanting to dissolve themselves, destroy their own group. I was at if you want to be the head of the German government, you have to express your hatred of the German people and your desire to see them disappear. In the United States, we have something similar, right? Trump is hated. He's, I love the American people. We should preserve ourselves. Biden, you're systemically racist. You're tainted with this. They love him. They can't have enough. I mean, it's the same kind of insanity. And I'm saying, are you listening to what these people are telling you? They obviously don't care, okay? Or they don't take this seriously. Or that, you know, we might get something free from the government or something, so they just go along with this. But I really think Western white Christian society is on a suicide course. This is not true in Eastern Europe, however. I mean, Poles, Hungarians, others, Russians, you know, they're going to preserve themselves. And of course, part of the reason for that is they were untouched by American bourgeois liberal. It's not really bourgeois liberalism, but progressivism, which we, you know, they were not reeducated by Americans. They were not exposed to our movies, our leftist values, and so forth. And those societies, you know, seem to be almost a holdover from the interwar period. They just keep going on. You know, I'm not concerned about them. I am, but, you know, as a friend pointed out, it's the more dynamic Western societies that seem to be destroying themselves. You know, they open their borders, Muslim fundamentalists come in, they spend their time trying to eradicate their own history while giving special favors to Muslims and other groups that hate their guts. You know, but someone was complaining. I'm saying, you know, instead of worrying about a mosque being this high or where the muezzin stands, you don't want these people, don't let them in. I mean, who's forcing you to let them in? Right. You know, you look at a country like Israel, I don't see them running, you know, to beg more Arabs to move into their country. Do you? They don't. The Japanese don't do things like, you know, they don't let people in the hospital. I mean, why are these so-called Western democracies, which long ago ceased to be democracies, why are they letting their enemies in, or people who hate their guts? Why are they letting them come in? You know, or why do whites in the United States submit to their own humiliation? You don't have to hate other races. Why do you hate your own? You know, I'm quite happy to like the other race can like itself. White should like. But why degrade yourself? Why blame yourself for the ills of other groups who are more often than not responsible for their own conditions, and certainly are in a situation in which they can improve them?
And this is the last time I'll say this before the last call, but if you have a reasonable and responsible question or comment from Paul or myself, please do leave it via Streamlabs and leave it as soon as you can, because the last call is coming. Now from, let's see here, Jonathan, would you want to have on Peter Lavelle and George Zamueli of the Gaggle on sometime? They are interesting intellectuals who talk about U.S. and geopolitics. I've heard of George, you know, I hardly pronounce his last name. And I've even heard of Peter Lavelle, too. I need to check it out a bit, but I think it sounds like a very interesting prospect. Thank you for bringing it up, Jonathan. Paul, anything to say about what Jonathan brought up?
Yeah, the last name is Samueli. Yeah. And his ancestor was part of the ruling communist presidium in Hungary after the First World War in the Béla Kun government. I know him. It would be Samueli György, an Hungarian. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad to see he's still around. I knew him about 35 years ago. He was then sort of a young fellow. I would not object to having him on a program.
Excellent. Thank you for bringing that up, Jonathan. I will look into it. From K-Max McDonald, who is your least favorite of all Fox News commentators? My vote goes with Sean Hannity. Sean Hannity could get 50 million viewers and the GOP would still lose. His advice is terrible. Do you agree? And are there others like this? I do agree. I don't think Hannity's heart or mind, his mind probably is in the wrong place, but I don't think his heart is in the wrong place. But I think that he is he's just not a very intelligent guy.
He's being very kind.
He's not a good person to really make complex arguments and simplify them so they have some appeal to, you know, a critical mass of people. As you mentioned, you can still get 50 million viewers and the GOP probably would still lose. His advice is often very bad. He very much goes soft on issues of race relations for whatever reason. I don't know why he does that. But among other things, it's not just that. And there are, of course, others like that in the GOP. There's a whole wing of the GOP. This is sort of like the holdover of the Bush year. That's what Kennedy represents. That is this sort of Jack Kemp conservatism that really is not worth writing home about. So that's my take there, K-Max. Paul, anything to say about K-Max?
Yeah, I don't know where I'd even begin. I mean, I will not disagree with you about Sean Hannity. I think he's a thorough buffoon. But where do I put Dana Perino? Mark Levin, you know, who's always ranting. There's so many of them I think are just awful. And, you know, when I think back of about the conservative movement, let's say in the 1960s, they seem like intellectual giants compared to these people that I see on Fox News. My all-time least favorite, however, and I won't say Mark Levin, there's someone I like even less, it's Glenn Beck. I mean, he just is raving, and it's about how Martin Luther King is going to save us, and everything is the fault of Martin Heidegger. ask me why. No, he's a total maniac. Oh, there was something on Glenn Beck, though, that, you know, somebody asked me about this. Asked him what I thought. Somebody said, you know, is Nazism a problem? And the answer was, Nazism always existed. It exists. It's all over. And I said, oh, here I was as an historian. I was under the illusion that it existed in Germany. And it's certainly, no, it's all over. The Democrats are Nazis. You know, everyone's a Nazi. He must be the stupidest. I mean, even though he's recovering alcoholic, druggy, or whatever it is, there's no excuse for his stupidity.
He wrote a book, I think, called Being George Washington or something like that. And he was on the cover of this book about George Washington. It was ridiculous. Beck is deaf. He also supported Black Lives Matter when it first started.
Did
obviously. Oh, yes, he did. He told the New York Times.
My opinion of him is so low that it cannot sink any lower.
Beck is something else. I think he has problems, to say the least, and that infuses his very, shall I say, erroneous perspective, and that's being very kind. You don't hear all too much from him nowadays, though. Ever since he lost his Fox News spot, he's been sort of AWOL, even though he is still around.
Yeah, they still let him on, you know, every now and then. I can't think of anyone, except for Tucker Carlson's monologues, I can't think of anything else. Well, they do. Dan Bongino is highly articulate. You know, he's very good on Law and Order issues. There's a fellow named Joe Concha, who's very good on Democratic scandals. They have Miranda Devine. There are a number of people who are there who are quite good on Democratic scandals and on things the Democrats get away with. And I think they're the most valuable contributors to Fox News by far.
Certainly. You know, it would have been interesting if they ever invited Bob Wenzel on Fox News.
That wasn't going to happen.
He would have just gone over their heads. It really, right. It would have been something. Imagine Sean Hannity and Bob having a discussion.
I can't imagine.
Or Sean Hannity and you having a discussion. That would be interesting.
No, you know, it's interesting. Sometimes he has Larry Elder, who's this black journalist, who's quite bright. You know, and he writes very good columns, Elder. Like, for instance, he had a column yesterday showing that blacks improved economically the most between 1910 and 1950. They went from 90% poverty to 40% poverty. And I think Thomas Sowell showed this too. The civil rights movement did very little to improve the economic conditions of blacks in America. Elders will tell you this. But I mean, sometimes he sits there, he has to listen to Hannity, and I would hope he's as embarrassed as I think he is. You know, the Hannity, if you remember, went after Biden for opposing forced busing. He thought that was racist. Or yes, for voting for the crime bill, which it was excellent. And at the time it was passed, you know, because of the high crime rate. But these were apparently racist acts. There was some joke Biden made about people with Indian accents in McDonald's or somewhere. This was supposedly a racist remark. I have no idea what makes it racist. Mm-hmm. But Hannity keeps bringing this up on his shows.
I have a joke name for Hannity. Hammer. I think it really explains itself. Let's see. Oh, sorry, Paul, did you cut out?
I am all through my comments.
No, I said that I
will be eloquently silent.
No, no problem. No, before we move on, I said I have a joke name for Sean Hannity, Hannitard. I think it very well describes the man and his where he's coming from. Of course, it's not meant to offend anyone else. Okay, let's see here from David B. What is the secret to Paul's youthfulness?
I don't know. Am I youthful? Well, I'm certainly not as decrepit as most people my age, but I don't think I'm exactly youthful.
I know. I think that, well, it's obviously a very high compliment. I obviously have no idea as to what the secret to Paul's relative youthfulness is, but very kind words from David B. all the same.
Well, thank you. I'm not, as I said, I have sciatica, so I can't even run anymore. So I'm not as youthful as I was about a month ago, or 4 months ago, before the sciatica inflicted itself on me.
Well, hopefully it'll go away at some point, and then you'll be...
Yes, after I die. I think I'm going to lose it before then.
It can be very difficult, for sure, but at least you're still around. That counts for a lot.
That's right, I'm still around.
And now this is the last call. If you have a reasonable and responsible question or comment from Paul or myself, please do leave it via Streamlabs. We'll get to it before we go, but this is the last call. Thank you very much in advance. Let's see here from Row House. Why do you think, who do you think would likely try to challenge or could challenge Trump in the 2024 primaries if he runs? I really can only think of Ron DeSantis or maybe Josh Hawley. Or do you think a neocon like Nikki Haley would likely win? I don't think anyone would likely win against Trump in the 2024 GOP primary. I think it's his if he wants it, and by all indications, he does want it. Ron DeSantis would never run against Trump, nor would Josh Hawley. I think that both will be around, though, in 2028, running for president. I don't think there's much doubt about that. Hawley could not win a national election. DeSantis, I have doubts about because of his bad campaigning traditionally and his lackluster personality. But he could be coached so that he does a fine job in the campaign trail by 2028. It's very possible. I think that DeSantis wants to go run for the U.S. Senate, certainly. That's what he did run for before he ran for governor. So I think when the next, you know, open U.S. Senate seat comes about in Florida, DeSantis will be there running for it. Whether or not that happens before 2028, who knows? But I think that, as you know, Nikki Haley couldn't win a GOP presidential primary today. I think she said she would. run if Trump does. It'd just be a vanity run to make money. I don't think she would even think she has any serious chance of claiming victory over over Trump. Paul, anything to say about what Roe House?
No, I agree with you. You know, I think both either Hawley or DeSantis would be a good candidate, but I don't think either one is going to challenge Trump because they're both, you know, they're what should we say, a Trump populist, or at least that's the way they identify themselves right now. So they're not going to go against the leader of their movement. However, I do think it'd be a good idea if Trump did not run in 2024, and if Hawley or DeSantis ran in his place, I would not want to see Nikki Haley. But I don't think she could possibly get the nomination.
No,
I think most of the Republican base would probably oppose her because she, well, she is closely identified with the neoconservatives, but also she turned on Trump. Right. I mean, after January 6th, and I think that might be held against her.
I have no doubt that it would be. That would be, you know, a major point of concern for anyone who doesn't want to go back to more or less the George W. Bush era, which the GOP base is simply not interested in, to say the to say the absolute least. Let me see. Go back here to Streamlabs, see if anything else came up. In the meanwhile, I'm refreshing the page, but it's doing its little spinning thing, the cartwheel. I don't know why it does. Well, I mean, I know why it's, I don't know why it takes so long. That's what I meant. But sometimes it does, and what are you going to do? It's spinning, it's spinning, it's spinning. If it doesn't stop spinning in a second, I'll have to talk about something else while I wait for this thing to load. But okay, it is loading. It's coming along. No, nothing else yet. Obviously, the last call was made. So, Paul, as we begin to wrap things up here. I really obviously am very much saddened by the passing of Bob. And there never will be anyone else like him. There was some chatter among those who knew him about who's going to take over EPJ or Target Liberty. And nobody, I think, can really run these things as he ran them. He had his own unique approach, and the insight that he brought to these publications is so unique that it can't be replicated.
No, I agree. And he was involved in so many activities, you know. So you probably need 10 people to replace him. But I think that may have been one of his problems, that he was just stretched too thin, you know, and he could not go on, you know, controlling all of these activities effectively beyond a certain age. I think some of them will just go by the wayside. I mean, I'd be very hard to maintain all of them. But our activity on this this program will continue.
Most certainly, yes.
Right.
Yes. Now, Bob didn't own this program. I'll just throw that out there. But he was certainly someone who helped it along, and that is greatly appreciated. Mm-hmm. It always shall be. But no, he had many different projects going on, and he had really so much energy and so much drive to do these various things that were unrelated to each other, just as different realms of interest, that I often wondered how he had the time or the energy to make all this stuff function. And, you know, he did, but I think he lived so fast that his time came earlier than it otherwise would have.
Yes, that's true.
It's very hard to imagine anyone having his drive who is younger. I think perhaps most who were born, you know, later than he was, simply were not raised to be that enterprising. You know, I could be wrong. There's always, you know, the needle in the haystack, but I think that finding someone to do all the stuff that he did is just really, nobody's going to do it like he did. But I think it's impossible just to find someone capable of running as many things that he ran. That's almost impossible.
Yeah, well, one of the things I found remarkable about him was that he was, the way he would travel around, I mean, he was so peripatetic. I remember he was talking to me in Baltimore. He said, tomorrow I have to be in San Francisco. Then I have to fly back to New York the next day. And this, I mean, if I had that kind of schedule at any age, I would have, you know, I would have been worn out after about a week. But he was like, you know, he was then over 60 and he was just flying from one place to another. And this didn't seem to bother him at the time.
No, it didn't bother him at all. He was always going yeah. places, always. He also went out into the onto the streets of San Francisco, and he would interview people and talk to them, and he liked to confront them about masks and such. He hated wearing masks, and he refused to get the vaccine. And what he actually did was he got ordained as a minister at one of those online churches, and he bought himself a minister's garb. The collar and everything. I think he even got like holy oil as well. He did this. In California, there was an exemption with curfews and I think masks for ministers. So he became Reverend Wenzel. And he actually went around all day like that. And I would say, you know, Bob, you should form your own congregation, the Branch Wenzelians. And it obviously was a joke.
Well, I assume he was a mask skeptic.
Totally. He hated masks. He hated wearing. He hated getting vaccines. He actually told someone, I think, once upon a time, that he had COVID when he walked into a store when they asked him, "Do you have COVID?" And he didn't. He just said it to them to get him angry. He was something else. He just liked. He very much enjoyed the social experiment. There was this one guy who was living in his building. He posted a video of it. This was last year. And Bob was trying to walk into the elevator. And the guy was screaming at him, "Don't get near me. You're going to kill me. You're going to kill me." And Bob said, "How am I going to kill you?" He said, "You're not wearing your mask." He said, "Buddy, I'm just walking into the elevator." And the guy kept screaming. And he was a crusty. He was effeminate. And he had his dog that he was walking. It was something else. It was really fun stuff.
So Bob could have said that he was demonstrating with Black Lives Matter. And therefore, he was not required to wear a mask.
That's yeah, he could have said that.
Or he was an illegal who just crossed the border and didn't have to wear a mask. There are all these categories of people, you know, who are excused. As long as they're illegal or burning down a building or something, it's okay to wear a mask.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's really a bizarre, you know, set of double standards that we have going now. But I'm not surprised in a society that I think is as fractured and as ill-fated as the United States, this sort of stuff is sort of par for the course. Mm-hmm. It's really like a third world thing. Bob was considering leaving the country at some point. He was thinking about going to live overseas in the event that the lefties took over here. So he, thankfully, I guess he never, like say, even though it's not good that he died, but it's at least good that he never had to resort to that. But he was very skeptical about the political future of the United States. And it's difficult, you know, nobody can blame him for that. It's just a really crazy state of affairs.
You know, I would agree. If I were like a young man, I'd move to Liechtenstein or someplace like beautiful places up in the mountains, and I speak German, so that would be fine, or French or something. I think you have to sort of look for interstitial areas, you know, that have been unaffected. Like Liechtenstein is run by a grand duke, so it can't be, and he's not radicalized, you know, he's like almost medieval, so relatively safe.
But it's not very democratic, Paul, isn't that?
Well, that, I don't want that's one of the many advantages.
I agree. No, I'm in favor of liberty. Democracy is not necessarily the friend of liberty. Very often it's not the friend of liberty at all. It's a sworn enemy.
No, I agree. And I think inevitably democracy does move in a liberticide direction. It becomes the enemy of liberty, you know. And I think most critics of democracy have been aware of this for a very long time. I began criticizing the notion of democratic capitalism years ago. I mean, people say you can only have free enterprise in a democracy. What democracy is free enterprise? I mean, they always have social programs and redistribution, and so because everybody's voting, right? And the government tries, and then typically the government takes over everything in these so-called democracies and determines, you know, what liberties you're going to have or not going to have.
Yes, it does, and I mean that's unfortunate for a host of reasons. But anytime you have a managerial state that's designed to essentially provide therapy to people who are, you know, they feel angry about something or they want some ill of theirs, you know, whether it's that they're poor or they feel maligned, they want that sort of thing to be cured. You're going to have a scenario where the government discriminates against people in order to get this done. And that most definitely is the enemy of liberty.
Yeah, what makes it interesting, and of course I have this trilogy I wrote on this, what makes it interesting is that you would think the managerial state would work this way, so that we're going to, this person is unhappy with this. What we've done now is we divided society into victims and victimizers, right? So if you're a victimizer, you have no right to complain because you victimize other people. If you're a white male or something like that, right? You've caused this. If you're a white male Christian Southerner or something, you've caused all these people to suffer, right? So you have no, what rights do you have? I think we've sort of moved in this direction. So it's not that everybody's grievance is going to be addressed. It just, some people are allowed to have grievances and others are not, you know, because they've supposedly have caused all the problems just by being on this planet, you know, just by being around, you cause it.
It's unfortunate, but that's exactly the situation that we're confronted with. And I don't think it's going to get any better anytime soon. I think this is just a long-term negative trend in American society, and for the most part, Western society.
Itself. Yes. Yeah, it's worse in other countries in the West. We are one of the least infected by it. I mean, which is scary, but we're the least. I mean, Canada is much worse. Germany is worse. There are a lot of other countries that are, Spain. They're all worse than the United States.
Yep.
Yeah, we're on the same, I don't know, we're probably on the same trajectory with France or England, one of these other countries. Italy, I think, is probably a lot better because their government doesn't function, you know, so they can't do much to you.
They're in
Italians
the EU.
Don't have much government to their credit, you know.
Oh, I agree. I was going to say, they're in the EU, which is not a great situation, but Italy's government itself has its definite benefits.
Yeah, I mean, they even had, I think, a quasi neo-fascist government, which really made me like them. You know, the leader said something nice about Mussolini or the fascist era. I thought, you know, this was extraordinary. extraordinarily non-repressed or something compared to some of these other countries in Europe, Western Europe. But, you know, the United States is not the worst, you know, of these politically correct countries. And I said we probably have a long way to go before we reach the level of self-degradation and total control you find among the Germans or Canadians.
On that bright note, and this actually is a bright note to end on, I just refreshed Streamlabs and I don't see anything new there, so I think we're done with that. Paul, this has been a great discussion tonight, a relatively sad one in certain respects, but great all the same. We definitely dealt with a lot of very important issues. I think we paid good tribute to Bob Wenzel.
Well, thank you. I think it is.
Excellent. Yeah. And, you know, I will do a special closing tonight. And I'll do it in case anybody didn't see the first part of the episode. There's an endorsement of the show that I really think just speaks for itself. And it came from the fellow that we are delivering our memorial to here tonight. But I will say that thanks for tuning in, everyone. See you next time. Before we go, though, if you like this episode and want to support the show, please consider donating to it by clicking on the PayPal link in the description below. Paul and I appreciate your generosity very much. Cheers, all. This has been a very great discussion, Bob. Thank you for stopping by. We wound up going over time and discussing much more than Amazon, but it was an absolutely worthwhile discussion all the same. And it should go without saying that anytime you'd like to come back on the show, let me know, because there's always something to talk about.
Okay, great. Joseph, enjoyed it. Always enjoy the show. And I always enjoy your conversations with Paul Gottfried. You guys do a great, great job. Extremely underrated show. One of the best going. I learn a lot every time.